Hello and welcome to Rippercast, your podcast on Jack the Ripper and the Whitechapel Murders. As we look forward to this year's East End Conference taking place 2 weeks from today, on the 11th and 12th of October, in the heart of the East End of London, we are bringing you 6 talks from the East End Conference of 2024, starting with Adam Wood and Wall of Flame, the bombing of the Tower of London, 1885.
Hello. Thank you, everyone. Welcome to the 2024 East End Conference on behalf of Adam, Andrew, Abby, Mark, and myself. It's a pleasure to invite you here today to the Astronomer Pub. It's 5 years to the day since I stood behind this lectern. Still absolutely petrifying. It is every year. This is Abby's first year as one of the organisers. There she is, sat in Orion over there. And we welcome her. She's been an absolute... Well, we've needed her, let's just say that. These conferences take over a year, sounds mad, but we were already working on the 2025 one. We have a Facebook group which just never, ever ends, ever. And the first 9 months of it is just me saying, I really must write something for the pack. But it just never ends. We're already well into the 2025 show. This is an incredible opportunity to listen to some fascinating talks, to meet up with friends old and new, and of course to look up every now and then and find Tony Dennard's canvas staring at you. He gets me every year. We hope you enjoy the packs, actually. We tend not to talk about them much, but they take a great deal of work, and I just looked it through, and Andrew's done a fantastic job, as he does every single year, so we really hope you enjoy them. One thing we're going to ask for this year, which we've never asked before, is that you stay in your seats. There's a few reasons for that, one of which is basically if someone thinks, actually, we're going to sit over there for this talk, then you might be sitting in the middle of some people who haven't seen each other for a while. So if you're happy with your seats, can we ask you to sit in and stay in them for the duration of the conference? We've got 6 talks, as we always have. There's been a bit of a change this for the first day, though. Unfortunately, Steph's had to drop out. So we've got Mark, who's going to be giving a talk on peculiar people. Absolutely no comment from me there. So today's running order is Adam, then Philip, and then Mark. And tomorrow we've got Steve and Alistair, and then a talk with Paul Begg to wrap up the conference. I reached out to the Facebook group for questions for Paul. Some extraordinary questions came back. Paul, I hope you like the film Pretty in Pink. He's nodding. There's a forensic investigation into that film. Thank you for that, Susie. Again, as we say every single year about the bar tab, if when you're ordering drinks and food here, can you just show your lanyard? We've got a minimum bar spend and we need to know exactly where the money's come from this room. I don't think that's going to be a problem, it seldom is. Once again, we have a photo competition. There are 9 entrants this year in the New Views of Gunthorpe Street competition. every year. So it's 9, isn't it, Mark, we've got?
19, I think.
I was told 9. Okay, 19. Wow. And we also have Adam's books here for sale. Are you selling your books, Adam?
Yeah, from lunchtime onwards.
From lunchtime onwards, we're selling Adam's books. There will be a raffle, as usual. Here are the raffle prizes. That will be run by Abby and Mark. Mark in Centaurus, Abby in Orion. I'm going to mention the room, because it's going to confuse the hell out of the podcast people. I said, if you could buy those, if you have the correct change, that would be incredibly helpful. Being asked to do that. One of the raffle prizes is a copy of the 2007 Wolverhampton Conference pack. Apparently it's a good pack. I've been told. This year's charity is Beyond the Streets, so the more tickets you buy, the more chance you've got of winning, but more importantly, there's more chance of a very, very, very good cause receiving some money from that. There's also the walk tonight. This is going to be run at 7:30 by Philip and Dorothy outside the Hoops and Grapes. Does it finish there as well?
No, Princess of Prussia. Princess of Prussia on Prescott Street.
Yeah. There you are, you heard that. So it's going to finish there. The Hoops and Grapes, of course, is a fantastic pub. A lot of people go there already and get very, very drunk. Which leads me, Susie. That Susie tells me there's no official curry tonight. It's like organising D-Day, apparently.
Tomorrow night.
So please don't sit, stand and break late thinking, where is everyone? So there is an official sort of conference curry night this year. If anyone wants to volunteer to run that next year, feel free. Have a lovely time.
At your own risk.
At your own risk. And a threat to your own mathematics skills. The conference ends with, as it does every year, with the Catherine and Moon Ward. We're just really looking forward to it. It's taken a lot of hard work to get where we are today, so we really, really hope you enjoy it. You people make this conference, and we're really going to enjoy ourselves. Which leads me to our first talk, which is by Adam Wood, and it's about the bombing of Tower Bridge in 1885.
Tower of London. Steve Cole does his research every year.
Tower Bridge didn't even exist. They got there early. Well, not just in case. That's exactly what I meant. Adam Wood.
Hi everybody, can you hear me at the back there?
Yeah.
That's a shame. thank you. This is obviously the title of the talk, Wall of Flame, which I think is very evocative. It's actually a contemporary quote from a newspaper report. I'll be quoting it in full later on. I'm sure most of you know about the dynamite campaign in London in the 1880s, culminated in the Tower explosion. I should say, before I start, when we were planning the itinerary for the weekend, my fellow organisers said we need a talk that starts with a bang. This is about the best you're going to get. So, Tower of London explosion actually ended a period of Fenian campaign, dynamite campaign, in the 1880s. And as you can see there, from the Evening News of 1885, supposed dynamite explosion at Tower of London, down the Houses of Parliament this afternoon. Great excitement. Yeah, great excitement. But this campaign from the 4 years of 1881 to 1885, actually there's a big backstory to that. As obviously being 1885 doesn't feature Jack the Ripper as such, it does end in the East End. And there's some very important Jack the Ripper names such as Frederick Abelein. Inspector Donald Swanson. But if we look at some of these major events in British history, really, that culminated in the bombing of the Tower of London in 1885, you have to go right back to the 1860s and the Fenian campaign. I'm sure many of you read the books. It's a very, very complex subject. It's not easy to explain in probably in a book, let alone 45-minute talk. I'm going to simplify the sequence of events that starts with Fenianism in the 1860s, very briefly, and I'll go through to the dynamite campaign of the 1880s. I'm starting with this chap, James Stevens. The Irish Republican Brotherhood was formed in Dublin on St Patrick's Day in 1858 by James Stevens with one aim: to free Ireland from British rule. Unsurprisingly, it gained a large following in Ireland and beyond of an estimated 100,000 members by 1865. A branch was formed in America with the same aim, named the Fenian Brotherhood. Fenians attacked British army forts and other settlements, and on one occasion in 1866 attempted to invade Canada. These incidents were all calculated to impose pressure on Britain to withdraw from Ireland. As 1866 drew to a close, a lack of progress saw Stevens replaced as a leader of the Brotherhood by this man, Colonel Thomas Kelly, an Irish-American veteran of the American Civil War. This led to the Fenian Rising of March 1867 in England, which in reality was a poorly organised attempt at insurrection. Kelly and another leading member, Timothy Deasy, were eventually arrested on the 11th of September in Manchester, and a week later they were being transported to Bellevue Jail by a horse-drawn police van. This is one of the early incidents in the Fenian Uprising. As a van passed under a railway arch on the way to the jail, a man stopped in the road and ordered it to stop, pointing a pistol at the driver. Immediately, a gang of more than 30 Fenians appeared from behind a wall and surrounded the van, attempting to break in using an assortment of tools, including a sledgehammer and a hatchet. After Police Sergeant Charles Brett, travelling inside with the keys, refused to unlock the doors, one of the mob placed his pistol on the keyhole with the intention of blowing open the lock. At the same moment, Brett bent down to look through the keyhole, and the bullet passed through his eye into his brain, killing him instantly. And it earned him the unwanted tag of the first Manchester police officer killed on duty. A woman, among four other prisoners inside the van, with Kelly and Deasy, took the keys from Brett's body and passed them out via a ventilator, enabling the Fenians to escape. Kelly and Deasy escaped to America, never recaptured, but police raid on Manchester's Irish quarter resulted in 28 Irishmen being arrested on suspicion of involvement in the rescue, with five principal offenders tried under one indictment on the 28th of October 1867. At the trial of those arrested, in the aftermath of Sergeant Brett's murder, all but five were found guilty and sentenced to death by hanging, but two would be reprieved before this could take place. The remaining three men, William Allen, Michael Larkin and William O'Brien, were hanged by Executioner Calcraft in November 1867, and the trio became known as the Manchester Martyrs. Following the trial, several meetings have been attended on Clerkenwell Green in London by thousands of people, including Steve Ratty. They were appalled at the sentencing of the Manchester Martyrs, and their appeals for clemency came to nothing. And on the 24th of November 1867, the day after the hangings, a march left Clerkenwell Green to Hyde Park in complaint. The route took them away from the Middlesex House of Detention, better known as Clerkenwell Prison, where ironically leading arms organiser of the Brotherhood, Irish American Richard O'Sullivan Burke, had been taken following his arrest with a colleague, Joseph Casey, in London's Woburn Square 4 days earlier, for supplying weapons to Fenians in Birmingham. On the 11th of December, the Home Office received information of a plot to free Burke, which was scheduled to take place the following day. The plan was to blow up the exercise walls by means of gunpowder, roughly where the star is, between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the signal for all right being a white ball thrown up outside the wall while Burke was at exercise. The report was sent to Scotland Yard, and Commissioner Richard Main ordered that the prison walls be examined and watched by five police constables and three officers in plain clothes. The prison governor placed additional armed prison guards on the roof. At 3:30 in the afternoon, a man approached the prison wheeling a handcart bearing a large barrel, which he unloaded and placed next to the wall adjoining the exercise yard. He threw a white rubber ball into the air, lit the fuse and ran for cover. Burke, having seen the signal, did the same, and he waited for the explosion, which never came. The fuse had gone out, and a second attempt to light it also failed. With not enough length of fuse remaining, for a third attempt, the man placed the barrel back on his cart and departed. Unbelievably, a police constable had watched the whole thing, but he failed to consider it suspicious. A prison guard who saw the white ball thrown over the wall put it in his pocket and took it home for his son. At 3:45 the following afternoon, 13th of December 1867, a horse and cart were driven up Corporation Road to the prison, and two men unloaded a covered barrel, which they placed against the wall. Sitting opposite, playing with some burning paper, were two small boys. One of the men placed a firework on the pavement, which the boys picked up, and he positioned a second in the barrel. He declined the boys' offer with their burning paper, and instead lit a match and held it to the firework. As soon as it began to flare, both men and two boys ran. Constable Moriarty approached the barrel just as it exploded. All his clothes were blown off. We've all heard that one before. The prison wall, 60 foot long, 25 feet high and 2 feet thick, was demolished seconds later. The fronts of houses and shops along Corporation Road had also been blown down, with more than 50 inhabitants buried under rubble. Burke and Casey were at the time locked in their cells, the authorities having changed their exercise allowance on the morning to as a precaution. 12 members of the public died in explosion and over 120 were injured. And Justice, a Fenian supervisor who visited prisoner Joseph Casey pretending to be his aunt, was quickly arrested along with along with two men at a rented room in nearby Woodbridge Street from which Justice had been seen observing the prison. All three were charged with murder, but Anne Justice chose to cooperate with the police rather than face a death penalty and told them that a man named Michael Barrett had arrived from Glasgow 2 days earlier and that he was known to the other two men who had been arrested with her. Barrett was found back in Glasgow in January 1868 and arrested for murder. 3 months before the bombing, Home Office had decided to create a special department to deal with the growing Fenian threat, although nothing had been done up till that point. The day following the attack on Clerkenwell, Chancellor of the Exchequer Benjamin Disraeli wrote to the Prime Minister warning that the situation was serious and that action needed to be taken. As a result, the Counter-Revolutionary Secret Service Department was born. It was intended as a temporary branch. This man, Colonel William Fielding, was installed as its head, assisted by Captain William Whelan, and a young Dublin-based barrister named Robert Anderson. All three had experience of Fenianism in Ireland. A trial of Barrett and Justice and the others opened in April, each charged with the murder of Sarah Ann Hodgkinson, one of the victims in the explosion. Ann Justice was quickly acquitted, and the other men turned Queen's evidence and testified against Michael Barrett, who alone was found guilty of the bombing and subsequent deaths. On the 26th of May 1868, Barrett became the last man publicly held in England, when Calcraft again dispatched him outside Newgate Prison. The Clerkenwell outrage resulted in widespread panic and anger towards the Irish, and more specifically the Fenians. The bombing had been carried out by the Brotherhood, but by a small gang of London Irish, and the result was a sharp decline in public sympathy for the Fenian cause. In the immediate aftermath, Irishmen in London were called Mick Barretts as an insult, and this in time became shortened to simply Micks. With the shades of Lipsky there. The Counter-Revolutionary Secret Service Department was disbanded at the end of the trial, with Fielding and Whelan returning to their duties. Robert Anderson was invited by the Home Secretary to remain at the Home Office as Home Office Advisor on Political Crime. This is the background of the 1880s dynamite attack. So we'll move on to this now. 1881 to 1885. Salford Barracks. An empty preserved meat tin became the unlikely symbol for the beginning of a fresh campaign of Fenian terrorism when on the afternoon of the 14th of January 1881 it was stuffed with dynamite and lowered through a ventilation shaft into the butcher's storeroom at Salford Barracks. In Manchester. It was occupied at the time by the 85th Infantry Regiment, and minutes later a great explosion sent bricks, slate and other debris flying 200 yards into the air. The adjoining wall was demolished and the windows of more than 30 houses opposite were blown out. Passing at the time were a young woman named Mary Ann Nadin, who suffered a fractured arm and leg, and a 7-year-old Richard Clark, who was hit by debris by his left eye, fracturing his skull. Unsurprisingly, died 2 days later. While Fenianism had abated in Britain in the aftermath of the Clerkenwell prison bombing, in New York, a new organisation seeking Irish independence was established, which would have a major involvement in the events of future years. Clan na Gael was formed in June 1867 by Irish immigrant Jerome Collins and sought to unite Irish American Fenian factions by providing a common meeting ground for members of both the Irish Republican Brotherhood and the American-based Fenian Brotherhood. they conducted their plans in secret rather than public displays favoured by the IRB. Skirmishing Fund was created, into which Irish-American sympathisers to the Fenian cause made regular donations for the purpose of financing a dedicated group of revolutionaries prepared to wage a war in the shadows on Britain in the dynamite attacks. Chief among those of the skirmishers was Jeremiah O'Donovan Rosser, a prominent member of the IRB. He'd established a dynamite school in Brooklyn, where for $30 a month, a student could learn about manufacturing explosives. Many students came from Ireland and from the British mainland to be trained, and then returned to teach other Fenians. In this way, the skirmishing funds created a band of dynamitards set on destruction in the name of a free Ireland. They formed a strategy of targeting institutions of importance, recognised instead of choosing heads of state and other notable persons as victims by causing damage and disruption to infrastructure and buildings of significance, it could create panic and fear among the public. The focus of targeting prominent buildings was underlined 2 months later, when around 11 o'clock on the evening of the 16th of March 1881, City of London policeman Samuel Cowell was on his beat, which took him along a dark, narrow alley behind the Mansion House, the Lord Mayor's residence. He just turned into the alley when from Walbrook when he saw
what
fire
is your assessment
and smoke
of the state?
Wow, sorry.
Issuing from the recess in the window. PC Cowell hurried to the scene to find smoke billowing from a box wrapped in brown paper. Smothering the box to his chest to extinguish the flames, the constable then took the smouldering object to the police station. There, it was discovered just how narrowly PC Cowell's prompted action had averted disaster. The box, which was bound tightly with iron hoops, had a round hole in its centre from which a fuse protruded. The outer paper had been burned to within an inch of this fuse, and when it was opened, it was revealed a box contained £15 of coarse blasting gunpowder into which the fuse was positioned, a piece of old carpet bag and four recent newspapers from Ireland, Glasgow and America indicated the origin of those responsible. In early 1882, yet another Fenian faction was created, this time in Ireland. The Irish National Invincibles was composed mostly of extremist members of the Irish Republican Brotherhood in Dublin. Their aim was simple, the assassination of anyone preventing Home Rule. So-called coercion act had been introduced by the Chief Secretary for Ireland, William Forster, in an attempt to deal with the growing Irish National Land League, which had been used by Charles Parnell in October 1881, after his newspaper, United Ireland, had attacked the Land Act. Forster became public enemy number one as far as the Invincibles were concerned, and several attempts were made on his life. A treaty in May 1882 saw Prime Minister William Gladstone announce that Parnell would be released from prison, and in return, Parnell pledged to attempt to curtail future outrages. But they were denied their quarry through Forster's resignation and replacement by Lord Frederick Cavendish, and the Invincibles were determined to still taste blood, and he switched their attention to Thomas Burke, the permanent Undersecretary of the Irish Office based at Dublin. It was fine and warm as Undersecretary Burke strolled through Dublin's Phoenix Park with Lord Frederick Cavendish just after 6 o'clock on the evening of 6th of May 1882. Just that morning, Cavendish had been sworn in at Dublin Castle as Forster's replacement, and now the two politicians intended to take the evening air in the pleasant surroundings of the park. A brass band could be heard faintly playing in the distance as a cricket match further up the park neared its end. Inspector John Mallon of the Dublin Metropolitan Police was also walking through the park on his way to a meeting with informer John Kenny when he was approached by a plainclothes detective named Thomas Simons, who appeared highly agitated. Simons expressed concern for Mallon's well-being. He was asking the inspector his proposed route and whether he was armed. When asked to explain himself, Simons confirmed he'd seen a number of the Invincibles in the park that evening. Detective Inspector changed his mind about meeting John Kenny, and he made his way to his home nearby instead, only to see the informer run full pelt past his window minutes later in what was described as a state of terror, pursued by a thousand devils. Shortly afterwards, a detective called from Allen with the words, "Mr. Burke has been stricken to the heart, and there's another gentleman lying hard by, literally hacked to pieces." Mr. Maguire and a friend were riding tricycles through the park, and they passed Burke and Cavendish when they were on their way to the main route through the park. On their return journey, they found the bodies of the two men, Cavendish lying on a dusty main road in the middle of the carriageway, and Burke on the pathway. Both were lying in a large pool of blood. The hunt for the Invincibles' murderers began immediately. Posters were put up detailing a government reward of £10,000 for the capture of the assassins, with a further £5,000 and a pardon offered for information which led to the arrests. A list of likely names was already formed in Inspector Mallon's mind, and several of those was confirmed a week later when the detective was informed that conspirators included Joe Brady, Tim Kelly, Daniel Curley and James Carey. Under pressure, Carey turned Queen's evidence, and the look of hatred on the faces of 26 members of the Invincibles who stood in the dock, thanks to his evidence, can be imagined. Five were sentenced to death, and many more convicted of accessories and served long spells of imprisonment. The dynamite campaign now started in earnest. Three explosions in Glasgow in a little over 4 hours on the 25th of January 1883 signalled the return of the feeling of dynamiters. It was later claimed that the bomb had, on the Clyde Canal had been to destroy the viaduct over which it flowed, which would have resulted in the water filling from the canal, filling a distance of 16 miles, being drained into Glasgow city centre. 7 weeks later, dynamiters attacked again, this time in London. On the evening of the 15th of March, a small explosion sounded in the yard behind the offices of the printers of the Times newspaper. Men arriving at the scene found a box with flames shooting out, and a boy named Dawes, who was washing himself in the yard with a bucket of water, calmly handed it to one of the workmen, who promptly threw the contents over the box, extinguishing the fire. But there was little time to celebrate a near escape, because a short time later, with Big Ben striking 9 o'clock, a huge blast sounded across Westminster. At the House of Commons, where few members were still in debate, their debate was interrupted as the building shook. A whole convoy of fire engines sped to the source of the explosion in a large block of government buildings bordered by Whitehall, Downing Street and Charles Street, where they were met by a crowd numbering several hundred. It was evident a large bomb had been placed behind the ornamental balustrade of the local government building. Background there, this is King Street Police Station on the left. Sergeant Rose, shown in the sketch here, was walking along King Street when the explosion occurred. And at first he took it to be an earthquake. He raised his hands to his helmet to protect it falling from his head, at which point his hands were cut by a shard of falling glass. Hearing screams from a nearby house, Rose and another officer ran up the stairs to rescue a woman and her two children. The attack on Whitehall prompted the Home Office to finally do something to tackle Fenian activity at its source by infiltrating the communities and learning their plans. Since the disbanding of the Counter-Revolutionary Secret Service Department in May 1868, no dedicated government department existed in London to tackle terrorism. Robert Anderson, on the right, had remained attached to the Home Office as advisor on political crime, but had little to do. The result, set by the Home Secretary, was the Fenian Office, the embryonic political arm headed by Howard Vincent, aided by Chief Inspector Donnie Williams on the left. The branch was led by Detective Inspector John Littlechild, who later recalled, "As the years rolled on, all those officers who obtained a knowledge of Fenian conspirators in the 1860s had either died or left the service. And in 1881, when the first rumblings of fresh troubles were heard, I was instructed by Mr. Williamson to take up the matter as a special study. And every point calling for inquiry was referred to me." On the 19th of March in 1883, the new department was announced in police orders, with 8 officers recruited from across the divisions. 4 detectives from the CID were temporarily attached to the new branch, which would be based at Central Office Scotland Yard, under the command of Chief Superintendent Williamson. The department was responsible to the Home Secretary and would liaise with Robert Anderson. So at 10 o'clock in the morning of the 20th of March, 5 days after the Whitehall bombing, the Special Irish Branch met for the first time. There's a nice contemporary sketch of Williamson, you can see the text there, the head of the Dynamite Detection and Ferreting Out Department. It's better than me, Mark. But 7 months after the formation of the Special Branch, the growing network was tested with a campaign of a new terrifying turn as the Dynamitards returned to targeting the London Underground. Getting towards the Tower of London here. On the 30th of October 1883, passengers on a platform waiting for a train at Charing Cross Underground Station were thrown to the floor as an explosion blasted out in the tunnel between that station and Westminster, half a mile to the west. Plates of glass in buildings at both stations shattered as lamps were extinguished, simultaneously in a large cloud of black smoke mushroomed out the tunnel into the platform at Charing Cross. 3 minutes later, another bomb exploded just 50 yards out of Praed Street, as Paddington Day, on the opposite side of the Capitol. A train had just left Praed Street on the way to Edgware Road when the explosion occurred, causing serious damage to 6 carriages and 62 people were injured. In the early hours of the 26th of February 1884, an explosion took place at Victoria Railway Station, which destroyed the cloakroom where the bomb had been deposited and the booking office, and the entrances of the subway was filled with rubbish. The area's devastation measured some 100 feet by 65 feet and 30 truckloads of debris would be removed. Conservative police searches revealed that despite the devastation of Victoria, the capital had actually been fortunate. Bombs timed to detonate at the same time as Victoria bomb were found discharged as baggage in the cloakrooms of Charing Cross, Paddington and Ludgate Hill, each containing 20 pounds of Atlas Powder A, a dynamite manufactured in America. The bombs were constructed with American-made alarm clocks, the backs of which had been removed to allow a pistol to be attached by wires to the winder so that as the clock mechanism operated, the pistol's trigger was slowly squeezed. The pistol was loaded with a cartridge of fulminated mercury and pointed at the dynamite and would fire when the hands of the clock reached a certain time. This is the actual bomb found at Paddington. This was in the Crime Museum exhibition a few years at the Museum of London. While the Victorian bomb had worked correctly, the other 3 stations had failed as the timers ran down harmlessly, gave the Metropolitan Police their first clues. The bomb left at Paddington had been contained in an old brown leather travel bag, the fastening flap of which had been cut off to accommodate the mechanism. Part of the clock from the bomb was found in a black leather bag containing the bomb found at Ludgate Hill. While the cloakroom records at Charing Cross showed that the bag discovered it with the third bomb, lots of bags here, initially being booked in with a brown travel bag and then moved to Paddington. It seems certain that all 4 machines were made and deposited by the same perpetrators. Almost immediately, the police had a raid as a response to a reward of £1,000 when the proprietor of the Waverley Hotel on Great Portland Street came forward to report 2 men who had rented rooms and acted suspiciously in the days preceding the Victoria outrage. Detective Inspector Donald Swanson visited the Waverley Hotel the day after the explosion to take statements. He was told that a man had been at the hotel a week earlier with a single black bag. He was given a room on the 3rd floor and attended by the chambermaid named Louisa Sternham. On the Saturday, she was cleaning the room and noticed a second bag, a new black valise. Later that day, a second man arrived at the hotel and he took a room on the 1st floor. Although the 2 men were at pains to give the impression they knew each other, whenever they thought they were out of earshot, they spoke with one another continually, ceasing conversation as soon as anyone came in the room. On the morning of the 25th of February, both men paid their bills and said they'd be leaving that day. In the Victoria explosion, occurred 6 hours later. Swanson visited the hotel and took the bags and some putty which was found there, but before he could act on this information, fresh attacks took place on the 30th of May. The day started with the discovery at 10:30 in the morning of 16 packets of dynamite bound with the connecting fuse at the base of Nelson's Column. Had the dynamite been detonated, in addition to the horrendous loss of life, there's no doubt that the toppling of the monument to Nelson would have sent a potent message. The next target the same day would be a greater symbol still, Great Scotland Yard itself. Whether the Fenians intended to destroy the evidence that had been compiled, assassinate the detectives who were engaged in tracking them, or simply to make a major statement, a bomb was left in a public urinal situated in one corner of a building standing in the middle of the yard. Immediately above the urinal was the office occupied by members of the CID. John Sweeney, at the time a junior detective, but later rise to the rank of Detective Inspector of the Special Yard, was in the building at 9:25 when the bomb exploded, and he later wrote, "By a piece of extraordinary good fortune, there was absolutely no one in our offices. A few minutes earlier, there were two men in the building, one of the inspectors and myself. He went out just before me. I was busy making out a report. While finishing it, I also went out, thus escaping death by a quarter of an hour. The very desk which I'd been working was blown to pieces, and the crash was felt outside the yard. Many people were hurt, and the Rising Sun public house was very much knocked about. We could not console ourselves in the same way as the proprietor of the Rising Sun. Naturally, thousands of people flocked to see the effects of the outrage, and he charged threepence a head for admitting spectators. And what with this increase of custom, he more than recouped himself for the damage done to his premises." 1885 now, it had barely begun when another attack on the underground occurred, a bomb exploding between Gower Street and King's Cross Station on the evening of 2nd of January. A deafening blast ran through the tunnels into the platforms of Gower Street. One of the passengers of the train travelling through there, Mr. William Smith, later described the moment the bomb went off. He said, "There were two or three others in the compartment beside myself, and I occupied a corner seat with my face to the engine. We passed King's Cross without anything unusual happening and were chatting quietly together when we were terrified by a fearful crash like thunder, accompanied by an immense wall of flame, which seemed to lick both sides of the carriages. And for the moment it seemed that the tunnel was on fire. To add to the terror of the situation, both our lamps went out. We were left in total darkness. Several of the passengers cried out they were hurt, and some women in the next compartment screamed loudly." Terrible. In the months since the Victoria bomb, the capital had begun to relax about the possibility of attacks on the underground system, but the Gower Street incident reawakened panic and nervous anticipation. They would not have long to wait. Three major incidents on the same day would bring terror back to the city, but finally an end to the dynamite campaign. Dynamite hards chose Saturday the 24th of January to perform their most symbolic acts yet, with the attacks on the Tower of London and the House of Commons. I realised the weekend would be the perfect time to strike, with both locations being busy with tourists. At the peak visiting hour, 2:00 in the afternoon, a bright red light suddenly flashed in the Tower of London's banqueting room. Immediately followed by a terrific explosion, which was magnified by hundreds of rifles falling from their racks within the room and crashing to the floor. Fire quickly spread to the first floor of the White Tower and then to a council chamber on the second. The Grenadier Guards formed a cordon around the inferno before the Metropolitan Fire Brigade arrived to blast water at the tower. Hundreds of visitors stumbled in the dust in a panic trying to find the exit. As they approached the gateway, they found the doors locked. Scotland Yard, the City of London Police and local Metropolitan Police stations were telegraphed, with Assistant Commissioner James Monroe arriving with Superintendent Thomas Arnold and Detective Inspector Frederick Abberline of H Division at 2:40 p.m. Abberline was instructed to take the names and addresses and occupations of every person inside the tower gates. One of these was a 22-year-old Irish-American whose name was James George Gilbert of Sherbourg Street in Whitechapel. Abilene, who as we know had spent a great many years policing the area, knew there was no Sherbourg Street, and he asked where it was near, receiving the reply, Great Alley Street. Constable writing down this information piped up, do you mean Scarborough Street? And the man confirmed this was the name on the street he was lodging. But the man's delayed responses and general demeanour gave the experienced detective suspicious, and he took Gilbert to the police office within the tower, where Assistant Commissioner Monroe and Superintendent Arnold were waiting. While Abilene returned to continue questioning members of the crowd, the two senior officers took a statement from Gilbert. When Abilene returned to the office 45 minutes later, he was in time to hear the statement read back to the man, and he took him to his lodgings at 32 Scarborough Street, where he found a box and a dark black bag with papers suggesting his real name was James Gilbert Cunningham. Damningly also found was a small metal tube containing a white powder, chlorate of potassium and a fulminate of mercury, in other words, a detonator, and one which resembled those found at Charing Cross and Ludgate Hill. He was taken to Leman Street Police Station for further questioning. While these events were being played out, scenes of greater horror were unfolding at City Hall, at Westminster Hall. 8 minutes after the explosion at the tower, a small party of visitors to the crypts at Westminster noticed smoke and a strange smell emanating from what looked like a quilted petticoat lying on the steps. One of the group, a civil engineer named Edward Green, recognised the smell as a damp fuse, and he called for a police officer. PC William Cole, shown on the right, responded immediately and rushed to pick up the burning package, running up the stairs towards the hall with it in his arms. But finding hot acid burning his hands, he could not hold on to it any longer, and he threw it to the ground just outside the gates leading to the crypt. As it landed, a huge explosion ripped a hole in the pavement, some 6 feet long and 3 feet across, into which PC Cole and PC Cox fell. And investigations, turning back to Abilene and Cunningham, they went to his lodgings at Scarborough Street on the right. In fact, we're going to be going past here later on, Phil, on the end of your tour. I look forward to you pointing out which house it was. And they went to his previous lodgings on Great Prescott Street, on the left here. And the landlady at Great Prescott Street recalled that it arrived with a large brown trunk, which he claimed belonged to a friend who was lodging nearby. The brown trunk suspiciously disappeared and was replaced by a small black one. At this time, City of London Police Constable named Robert Wilson became suspicious of a fellow lodger at the address where he lived, named Harry Burton, who appeared to have no job, but he was constantly in and out of the house. Burton had arrived on Boxing Day 1884, taking the back room of the ground floor lodgings at number 5, Mitre Square. And if we ever look at this famous map of Mitre Square, you know what happened in this corner. This is where 5 was. It was actually taken up by the expansion of Curley and Tong warehouses by 1888. This is number 5 where Burton and PC Wilson were lodging in 1885. PC Wilson said that he saw Burton at the house just after 10 o'clock on the day he arrived. At this time, he was off duty and in plain clothes. This is a sketch. You've probably got the CGI Whitechapel, the CGI Jack the Ripper book. This is by Luke. And it shows like where number 5 would have been, and it would have looked very similar to numbers 3 and 4 there, as PC Watkins is doing rounds. A few days later, PC Wilson approached the front door, this time in uniform, and he saw the new lodger Burton struggling with the lock. The policeman opened it, but he couldn't help but notice that Burton seemed more than a little startled to realise he was living in the same house as a policeman. But reporting his suspicions to his superiors, plainclothes city detective Thomas Roper was assigned to watch Burton. He later testified, I saw Burton at 5 Mitre Square at 9:35 in the morning. He went up Mitre Street, along Aldgate and crossed the road, and went into Baverstock's restaurant in the High Street. This is now Peter's Cafe, you know the area now. three doors along from the corner of the Minories. I went back to Mitre Square to make inquiries and then returned to Aldgate 6 or 7 minutes after that. I saw Burton and Cunningham coming along the high street from Whitechapel towards me, about 10 yards off. When I first saw them, I was standing outside a public house next door, waiting for Burton to come out. It was raining very hard at the time, and Burton had his coat collar turned up. The prisoners were in conversation with one another, walking side by side. They passed me. I had a thorough opportunity of seeing Cunningham's face. I have no doubt of his being the man who was with Burton. And at this point, Burton's lodgings at Mitre Square were raided, and Special Irish Branch officers found Cunningham's brown trunk, along with maps and the tower on Westminster area. The 30-year-old Burton was arrested, and with Cunningham identified as the mysterious men seen at the Waverley Hotel, and who were reported to Inspector Swanson. A pair of Burton's trousers taken from his lodgings were found to be exactly the same size as some found at Charing Cross. When questioned by Detective Inspector Frederick Shaw, Burton swore he'd never seen Cunningham before, saying, "I was walking along Great Prescott Street one evening near the church. I saw a man with a brown box on the sidewalk. I said, 'Will you sell me that trunk?' He replied, 'Yes.' I asked him how much he wanted for it. He replied, 10 shillings. I said, 'I'll give you 8. I said, "Okay, I'll take it." I paid him in silver. The man looked after it while I fetched a cab. I don't know the man. I bought it from one, I've never seen him since." Okay, I'll believe that. Now, the trial of Burton and Cunningham took place at the Old Bailey under Sir Henry Hawkes on the 18th of May. They were found guilty of treason felony, sentenced to penal servitude for life. In the event, Gilbert Cunningham was released in 1893 and Harry Burton in 1899, both broken down through poor health. This is a sketch of the trial on the right-hand side here. This is Frederick Appeline's personal scrapbook. It's held in its entirety in the Met archives. This is the, we could recognise his famous picture of Appeline here. And next to him is Thomas Arnold. So for now, with the tower explosion and the capture of Burton and Cunningham, the Fenian threat was over. 19 bombs had been exploded in Britain, 11 in London, over a period of almost exactly 4 years. There'd be further scares in the years to come, most notably in 1887, when rumours reached Scotland Yard of a Fenian plot to assassinate Queen Victoria during her Jubilee celebrations. But the Metropolitan Police, and the Special Irish Branch in particular, would look back on the dynamite outrages with a sense of relief that the toll had not been greater. Chief Inspector John Littlechild would write, "There was a wide difference between the movement of 1867 and the 1880s dynamite campaign. The former was undoubtedly a Fenian rising, popular among all Fenians and having the avowed object of making a strike for Irish independence. But as regards the 1881 to 85 period, there's no intention of making a blow for independence. Certainly the patriotic element from which, no doubt, animated from the 67 Rising, was absent from the dynamite campaign. I know that many tried and trusted Fenians held entirely aloof from it. Makes me shudder to think of the consequences, if all these emissaries had been successful in their operations. That more lives were not lost is to me marvellous. The public does not realise the peril in which it was placed. It was indeed fortunate that dogged detection traced the steps of these desperados and the rest followed so surely upon their crimes. Terrorism was the object of this later movement in order to compel legislation in a desired direction. But that terrorism reckoned without its host. Evildoers rarely give Scotland Yard credit for efficient policing. So much the better for the public good." Thank you. Just one little teaser picture. Wouldn't it be good to if we had access to these?
Oh. Yeah.
But we don't.
Thank you, Adam. Excellent, it works. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. It works. Thanks very much. I thought that'd be more about Tower Bridge, to be honest. Thanks very much for that. Does anyone have, I'm doing the roving mic thing this year, so does anyone have any questions for Adam, please?
Good.
It's the dream scenario. Not at all.
I will point out that talking about Michael Barrett and the Clerkenwell bombing and Phoenix Park murders reminded me that actually I wrote about all of those in the A to Z of Victorian Crime, a copy of which is in the raffle today.
That's very good.
So I remembered some of that stuff.
Talking about Mitre's 5 Mitre Square, you'll find a representation of Mitre Square in the Whitechapel board game there, which is also in the raffle prize. You really ought to copy of that.
And signed by the designer, I think.
Yeah.
So it's number 5, it's also George Morris. I can't see the screen, that's why I say that. Is that sort of
George Morris area?
Not quite that far.
Not quite far across.
I'll turn it off now.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, we have a question. Excellent. And you have one.
So, Adam, I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
So, why did it all peter out then?
I think it was, as Little Child said in his later memoirs, it was basically the reaction to the fact that there were so many people injured. And in some cases killed, that there was just no sympathy. And I think that if the dynamitards had just carried on laying more and more bombs, there'd have been less and less sympathy, they wouldn't have achieved their aims.
Sorry, can I just add a little bit? Sorry.
Stay where you are.
Get your steps in.
I'll just stay here.
So, have you got any more information, or can you give us a sense of how these incidents affected the Irish living in the East End? Did anti-Irish sentiment continue after the campaign?
Absolutely. I mean, going right back to the execution of Michael Barrett, as you said there, Mix, as we still know it today, is like Lipsky, has become a derogatory term, is from that. And certainly after the Fenian 1867 bombings, there was an anti-Irish feeling, and in 1880s, there was a massive anti-Irish thing, and where I live at the moment in Coventry, there was an IRA bomb planted in 1939, and it basically destroyed and killed 5 people, destroyed a lot of Coventry city centre. For months and months afterwards, even this is the start of the Second World War, and Irish people living in Coventry were outcasted, and there was like marches going around from workers in the factories. We don't want these people working with us if they're going to do this. So it was quite common. Going right back to the 1880s bombing thing, I mean, as Little Child said, many of the people that wanted to do this uprising, or not uprising, but this Irish independence in the right way, they basically were sort of cringeworthy, distancing themselves from the bombings because this wasn't the way they should have gone about it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Adam.
Thank you.
Is this on?
Yeah.
When you read Conrad's The Secret Agent, you get a very strong impression of socialist anarchist activities in London in the 80s and 90s, but you've not mentioned any of those today. It's all Irish. How many were they, if at all? How accurate is the world painted by Conrad in The Secret Agent?
That's not something I've read, to be honest, Richard. I'll have to pick that up. Obviously, building up the backstory to Tower of London, bringing it into the East End, but certainly it'll go onto my list, so thank you for bringing up my teacher.
Thank you. I did it for A-level. I'm not doing a talk on it.
Okay.
It's French Park, isn't it? Thank you very much, Ryland. Thank you. Thank you very much, everyone. That's lunch for us. got two. That's lunch for us, so we're back at 2 o'clock to hear Philip's talk. If you are going to eat at the, or drink at the bar, again, can you show your lanyards? Thanks very much. Thank you.
And that was Adam Wood with Wall of Flame, the bombing of the Tower of London, 1885. We are a podcast sponsored and hosted by casebook.org, where you will find hundreds of roundtable discussions, author interviews, conference presentations, review shows, and so much more, all about Jack the Ripper, true crime, and Victorian history. If you have any questions or comments about the show, drop me a line at rippercastpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.